Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Cannabis, commonly known as marijuana, has caused considerable debate and political discussion. But just what is in this plant which causes such controversy? In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with Dr. William Courtney, a cannabis medical consultant based in Mendocino County, California. Dr. Courtney has studied the compounds of the cannabis plant known as cannabinoids, their various health effects, and the United States government patents held on these compounds. Further details on the legal status and current research relating to cannabis may be found on Dr. Courtney's website, www.leavesofgrass.info. This conversation with Dr. William Courtney was recorded in the studios of Radio Curious in Ukiah, California, on March 23, 2009. We began our conversation when I asked him to describe the compounds in marijuana. So, Bill, let's start with the structure of the marijuana plant and the cannabis and the cannabinoids that are within a marijuana plant that may vary from plant to plant.
For those who are comfortable with evolution, the plant's been around for approximately 34 million years. At this point, contains 66 of the cannabinoids. THC is a prevalent one in some strains. CBD or cannabidiol is a alternate that can either dominate or be in a reduced concentration. In addition to those two, there are obviously another 64, and each of them can have unique medical features that are being cataloged at this time, and strains are being grown which will emphasize one of the cannabinoids over the others so that you're able to kind of select, you know, cannabichromine, cannabigerol, cannabinol variant. So there's an incredible diversity that is beginning to be available and will help to improve tailoring the plant to individual needs.
Can you give us some examples of the difference between THC and CBD and some of the other 64 that you mentioned?
One of the biggest that has come to light for me over the last 3 or 4 years is that cannabidiol is known to be a non-psychoactive cannabinoid. That means it doesn't bind to the first cannabinoid receptor, which is in the brain and is associated with feelings of euphoria or dysphoria in some. And because it doesn't activate that CB1 receptor, it allows you to use 100 times more of it than you do THC. So a typical THC dose is like 20 milligrams. But it's the recommended dose for CBD can be 500, 1,000, or even 2,000 milligrams.
What purpose would CBD serve if a person were to use it or ingest it?
It is a very medicinal molecule in the plant, the most complex to date. It's the only cannabinoid that we know of that lyses anxiety, so it's called an anxiolytic. It's the only antipsychotic in the plant, which reduces the dopamine system and deals with, you know, psychotic episodes.
This is CBD as opposed to THC?
Yeah, this is CBD in particular. CBD and THC are almost polar opposite molecules. THC can make your heart race and cause anxiety. CBD is an anxiolytic and is calming and doesn't cause an acceleration of the heart rate. THC causes the euphoria. CBD does not cause any euphoric side effects or effects.
Basically a calming sedative.
CBN is the sedative in the plant. CBD is an anxiolytic, and that's really slicing fine hairs. But as we go forward, sedative is more puts you to sleep, so it's more of a hypnotic, whereas an anxiolytic can be used in the daytime just to calm you down if, you know, if arousal level has been accelerated because of coffee or personality or chemistry.
Or what we would call paranoid schizophrenia? Would it work in those kinds of circumstances as well?
I've had patients who have psychotic thought disorders, and what's interesting about those is they're very intuitive, and they know what part of the plant works best for them.
The patient is intuitive.
And particularly people with thought disorders can be intuitive in terms of their feeling state.
But when you say they know what part of the plant works best for them, would that assume that they would have a prior relationship with using CBD or one of the variants of marijuana?
Yeah, in particular, I had a patient that came to me, and him and his mother had been growing their own medicine for some time. Were quite poor and never could afford to use the bud. And so they were always stuck using the trim leaf. The son who had the thought disorder really was quite comfortable with leaf because there's a higher proportion of CBD in the leaf. And then once they were at a point of success to where the mother said, now you can use bud. We've got some extra, you know, use the good medicine. The son didn't like the bud. He would, you know, he said, I don't want to use that. And the mother said, no, that's better. This is the good stuff. Use the good stuff. And the patient was, it's not good for me. And so there's a lot of more THC in the bud. And then if there's a leaf components involved, there's going to be a higher proportion of CBD, and patients able to tease out that, you know, the leaf is much more calming as opposed to anxiogenic, which THC can be, and particularly in the strains that have been hybridized for, you know, very high levels of THC.
You mentioned THC, CBD, and CBN. How are they specifically related to marijuana as a more general name?
Those are called cannabinoids, and those are a class of 21 and 20 carbon molecules, and there's probably 8 major classes, and then within each class, there's 5 or 6 variants within a class. So that's how you build up to 66 total. But there's like cannabichromine, cannabigerol, these are the main classes, cannabidiol, tetrahydrocannabinol.
So what do some of these others do?
There's a fellow, El Soli, who's in the School of Pharmacy at the University of Mississippi working for the National Institute of Drug Abuse, who's been doing a lot of analysis and has published a book, I think it was last year, a very well-written book. It's a compilation of a number of authors. And one of the things that they've done in there is to list the chemical structure, divide it into the subclasses, and then identify the specific medical function of each of the cannabinoids within the classes. And there's a lot of blank spaces in that chart, but there's actually an awful lot of information in terms of CBD acid, a 21 carbon molecule, is an antibiotic. When you heat it, you break that carboxy group off, and then it becomes CBD, a 20 carbon molecule, and it's no longer an antibiotic. And at the last International Cannabinoid Research Society meeting in Scotland last summer, there was a lot of research about these 21 carbon molecules, which are very delicate. And really the only way to really have access is through eating the raw green leaf. If you dry it, if you heat it, steam it, simmer it, turn it into tea, saute it, all those break down those 21 carbons and they're lost. And with that, you lose unique medical properties that are no longer present in the remaining molecules. So every year, our knowledge of the medical properties and the additional cannabinoids are being identified as having more properties. So the knowledge base is growing at an amazing rate.
So on a bigger scale, are you indicating that the possibilities for physical health as well as mental health exist within the use and development of various kinds of marijuana? Kinds, talking about the 64 different forms of cannabis that you mentioned?
Those are the chemicals, the cannabinoids within cannabis. And then if you develop different strains, those will have a different cannabinoid profile. And so, I mean, essentially we're kind of talking the same thing, but as we develop strains that have a strength in a particular cannabinoid, there's a company in England, GW Pharmaceuticals, they have monoclonal greenhouses, a greenhouse which has genetic material from only one strain. There'd be up to 10,000 plants per greenhouse, no other plants in that greenhouse, so there's no exchange of genetic information between them. One greenhouse is predominantly CBD. There's a strain, G5, has 90% CBD, less than 4 or 5% THC. Another strain, G1, has 94% THC and very little CBD. Another strain has THCV, which is a variant of THC, but a significant one because it acts, you know, maybe a little stronger and quicker. And there'll be a whole greenhouse that the primary cannabinoid produced by those plants is THCV. And there'll be another one for cannabichromine, CBC, and another one for, cannabinol, CBN. And that way they do botanical extracts from the strain. So it's kind of, it's like using the plant to raise the medicine and then extract it from that plant once they find a strain that has a particularly strong suit.
How easily can this differentiation be done by someone who either wants to obtain some marijuana from someone else or grow it for themselves? How do they know what they're growing or purchasing?
Now that the hopefully the federal government is going to allow California to operate within the laws that its people elected, there will be more and more analytic labs. There's currently one down in Oakland that works in conjunction with Harborside that does an analysis looking for the cannabinoid profile, how much THC, how much CBD, possibly CBC. I mean, you could spend a lot of money if you characterized all 66 cannabinoids. So they'll take a selection of the 20 carbon molecules, and then they'll be looking for adulterants. You know, is there any inorganic pesticide? Is there any mold? And so as we become capable of getting routine analysis done, and a wide selection of the products that they sell at Harborside have all been analyzed. So you can, in addition to train wreck or, you know, some unusual name, there'll be a list of the components in that plant. And so hopefully in Mendocino, we'll be opening a lab very soon, which will allow the individuals to send in a sample and then get very specific information as to what is in that plant. And then if they want to do a hybridization or cross, they can see, okay, I take a very high THC and a high CBD, and I can make a third strain. And then they'll really begin to know what it is that they're growing and therefore have available for use.
So if they were to use it, create a hybrid, and then either ingest it by eating or smoke it, is there a way of understanding, other than interpreting one's own body feeling at the time, a way of understanding what effect it has? In other words, how does the grower know what they're producing?
Like I said, if this lab is set up and we're looking to set it up quite quickly, and you send in a sample, I've been growing this one strain for 20 years and I was interested in the profile, you send in a piece of either the bud material or the leaf material, and you'll get back an analysis, and it'll tell you what is in that particular part of the plant. And there's quite a variation as you move around the plant. Leaves near the apical meristem have some psychoactivity, whereas the shade leaves don't. And for those who are very sensitive to CB1 stimulation, generally individuals over the age of 40 are much less tolerant of the THC than those who are under 40. And one group becomes euphoric, the other group becomes quite dysphoric. And while they may be interested in the anti-inflammatory or pain relief, they're very much not interested in the dysphoria that that molecule produces in them. And so if you could find a strain that had very little THC but very high CBD, that would be more appropriate for those that are intolerant to the THC stimulation of the CB1 receptor.
Can you give us some definitions of euphoric and dysphoric and how they're manifested, how a person would interpret which sensation they're experiencing?
So eu is good, phoria is feeling, good feeling, dysphoria is bad feeling. Lots of times younger folks, when they inhale or ingest THC, become giddy, laugh at minor things, associate together. You know, a small phrase can become very humorous to a group that's all currently intoxicated. And then that same group, if they stop smoking once they leave high school or college and raise their children and don't use marijuana for 10, 20, 30 years, when they are now in middle age, they go back, and suddenly dysphoria is a negative feeling. It's, you inhale sometimes as little as a single inhalation, and their heart races and they become anxious. And with more, if they take another couple inhalations, they can actually become paranoid and fearful. So that's dysphoria, and becomes increasingly common with age, particularly for the person who has stopped using. If you start using as a young adult and continue daily use all the way through, you can actually decrease the density of the CB1 receptor and maintain a tolerance, and as well as the euphoria can persist for those who started using it early and continued using it more or less regularly. And then in that case, you can go all the way through with quite a bit of pleasant side effect feelings as opposed to quite uncomfortable side effects.
You mentioned inhaling, which I presume means smoking. What's the difference between smoking and eating?
Well, in addition to smoking involves combustion of the plant. Pyrolysis will destroy a lot of the contents. There's been a couple of studies recently on vaporization, in which what you do is you heat the plant material to a very specific temperature, and you boil that particular cannabinoid. It turns into a vapor, and you inhale the vaporized cannabinoid. What vaporization does is allows you to select among the cannabinoids, as well as avoid the products of combustion, which can be polyaromatic hydrocarbons, which have a carcinogenic potential, though not in this plant. The assumption was that because there are twice as many procarcinogens in cannabis, and that the way you inhale it is, if you are burning it as in smoking it, you take a deep breath and you hold it, that results in a deposition of up to four times as much tars as you would with a cigarette. So the early presumption being twice as many procarcinogens, four times the tar deposition, obviously cancer is going to be formed. And that presumption kept building and mounting in various anti-cannabis articles that were quite seriously supported by federal government looking for negative side effects. And they finally did a definitive study in Los Angeles, and it turned out that even very heavy users, there is no association with lung cancer despite the procarcinogens and deposition. And in fact, there was a negative correlation, which suggests that it would actually protect you, particularly if you're in a very somewhat toxic environment, like say you lived in a city where there's a lot of smog and a lot of car exhaust in the air. It could actually protect you from environmental carcinogens. And that was a very shocking finding from a study that was intent on proving that in fact cannabis caused cancer, when in fact it was protective of.
How about eating or ingesting through food?
Eating is an area that I have spent a lot of time looking at, and there's multiple ways of eating. For the last 30 years, there's been a growing association between psychoactive and medicine. And so essentially, the more psychoactive the effect, the stronger the medicinal benefit, was the assumption. And so many efforts were made to increase the psychoactive effect. And you'll hear people saying, well, you need to activate it with heat. You know, you THCA, you provide heat, you break the acid off, becomes THC, you increase the psychoactivity. So most of our activities involved sautéing, steeping in tea, simmering, smoking, any heat application. The more heat, the longer. You not only liberated THC from THC acid, but there's a possibility of converting CBD into THC through the addition of heat. I mean, it's a commercial process in Europe where they convert cannabidiol into tetrahydrocannabinol using heat. So what has come to light fairly recently is that there are different ways of eating the plant. If you bake it, you're going to increase the THC content, which was tantamount to increase the medical benefits. But it's pretty clear now that you shift the profile, and there are certain medical benefits that are reduced in that process. Now, THC has many medicinal properties, but because it stimulates the CB1 receptor, you're severely restricted on the amount that you can take in. Either through inhalation or eating, a 20 milligram dose is about as euphoric or dysphoric as someone can tolerate. Like I said, where with CBD, it's recommended in this patent that you take up to 2,000 milligrams. If you inadvertently took 2,000 milligrams of THC, you would be probably near comatose for many days. It would definitely be a 2 or 3 day period where you would be somnolent.
So how does one measure the quantity?
Looking at strains in the literature until we can actually get an analysis. So it's commonly held that CBD in Northern Lights in this county is about 1% of the weight of a pound of cannabis. So if a pound of cannabis is 454 grams, 4.54 grams of that are CBD. And it's very important that we understand that cannabis is an excellent source of CBD. If you look at the concentration of vitamin C in oranges, since grade school, most kids will say, you know, oranges are an excellent source of vitamin C. But it takes approximately 4 pounds of oranges to generate a gram of vitamin C. It takes only a quarter pound of cannabis to generate a gram of CBD, which is to say that there's 16 times as much cannabidiol in cannabis as there is vitamin C in orange. So cannabis is an excellent source of CBD, but on the other side, there is an incredible source of THC. And in order to use the CBD, you have to find strains where the THC is not present, or you need to reduce this THC content by vaporizing the THC and boiling it off of either the oil, the hash, or the plant. And then that increases the relative proportion of CBD.
Let's dissect, if you will, the alphabet soup, THC and CBD. For a person who really doesn't know what they mean, which I would suspect could be many listeners.
Yeah, so THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, the federal government says is the only active ingredient in the plant. At least that's, they've said that a lot. They've also said there's no medical benefit, and they have patents on the medical benefits of CBD. So there's many possible statements one can get from the federal government. But THC is the common compound within cannabis that is recognized to stimulate the CB1 receptor and cause euphoria, or as I said, in older folks, causes dysphoria. Whereas CBD or cannabidiol, being non-psychoactive, allows you to take 100 times more of it, which allows a whole different range of effects in terms of protecting the body from conditions of oxidative stress. And
as what are conditions of oxidative stress?
Life runs on oxygen. You inhale oxygen and you burn sugars with oxygen. So in every cell, you convert sugars into CO2, which you exhale. And as you burn a sugar into carbon dioxide, every time you chop off a carbon, you take the energy of that bond and store it chemically for the cell to grow or operate. Oxidation is essential to life. And yet the oxygen molecule is very, very powerful. It can turn iron into rust. It can turn cellulose into fire. I mean, you oxidize. Oxidation are all these processes. At a very controlled level, it's what metabolism is about. So you've got this beast, this very powerful chemical, and part of what life is harnessing that in a productive fashion. If you have uncharged oxygen molecules, superoxides, or what they call reactive oxygen species, those can destroy membranes, alter DNA, they can cause a lot of damage. And so oxidative diseases really run a very wide range of conditions.
What would be an example of an oxidative disease?
If you alter the perfusion, like of the heart, and you're going to have a heart attack, there's oxidative destruction going on around the ischemic event. And then when you bring blood supply back in, there's a second oxidative injury. Strokes, chronic conditions like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, conditions including cataracts involve oxidative damage. Diabetes, autoimmune disorders, any of the inflammatory conditions where inflammation is, the fire is kind of raging out of control, and that involves arthritides, rheumatoid and osteo joint conditions, post-traumatic conditions. So it really is a complication of most pathologic states.
Well, Dr. Bill Courtney, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious, and I look forward to another conversation to pursue these concepts. But before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting idea or concept or aha moment that has occurred to you lately.
The public discussion or discourse seems these days to be looking at economy. And I had the pleasure of being in China on a couple of occasions, and I've seen people willing to work very hard, for $1 an hour. And as the world kind of looks at the exchange of what we're all with time, and it seems like it's essential that America, who has been the consumer of the world, as we kind of come on par and exchange that pleasure with the rest of the world, we're going to have to change our position and an appreciation for other people's efforts and their homes. And it's going to require a leveling that I think is going to be very difficult for Americans who are used to having the ability to consume a lot of resources and maybe not put as much into the kind of global exchange. And so I'm thinking this is going to be a very interesting time in the next 4 or 5 years as the world economy reflects kind of a more balanced approach to people's time and effort. And
I'd like to say we're pretty curious about that.
Ooh, very curious.
And can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes, I have a very young daughter, a 3-month-old daughter, and have been really impressed with the continuum concept. It's by Jean Liedloff, and it's about the importance of, you know, holding the infant and child and making them a part of your working life and daily life, and opposed to, you know, putting them in front of a TV and putting them in front of a daycare situation, just really integrating them in your day-to-day life. And it's, you know, it's less than optimal if efficiency is all that matters, but there's an awful lot of benefit that comes from making them, you know, a day-in, day-out, 24 part of your life. And the book is really quite impressive, and it's analysis of some cultures in South America and how she saw the benefits that came to that kind of in-arms phase in which the infant was, you know, integrated into the community life.
Well, Dr. Bill Courtney, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
The pleasure's mine.
This interview with Dr. William Courtney, a cannabis medical consultant based in Mendocino County, California, was recorded on March 23, 2009, in the studios of Radio Curious in Ukiah, California. The book he recommends is Continuum Concept, In Search of Happiness Lost, by Jean Liedloff. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org.
There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.